Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm your host, Brian Lanzone. On today's show, Donna Cheek talks with the program coordinator of Partners in Equestrian Therapy. It's a unique riding program in San Luis Obispo for children and adults with special needs. The program helps people to increase their physical skills, confidence, and self-esteem through therapeutic horseback riding. Also, Cal Poly Emeritus Professor of History, Dan Krieger, discusses cemeteries, the Day of the Dead, Halloween history, and how they impact our culture today. But up first, Marisa Waddell visits with San Luis Obispo poet Kevin Patrick Sullivan, who's gearing up for the 30th annual San Luis Obispo Poetry Festival.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. Most Americans who can read and write have written poetry, and more write than read poetry. According to a study by the National Poetry Foundation, 64% of adult readers think that people should read more poetry. Well, here's your chance to read and listen to some poetry. The 30th annual San Luis Obispo Poetry Festival is coming up for the next three weekends, starting this Saturday at various locations around San Luis. The festival's artistic director, Kevin Patrick Sullivan, is here with me, along with poet Sylvia Alcon. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us here.
Well, it's my pleasure. Kevin, there are music festivals and film festivals and dance festivals. You're putting on a long-lived poetry festival. What makes a poetry festival?
Obviously, the poets that come and read, you know, and the people that come and listen. And so we've been very successful at bringing in some of the best poets in America to San Luis Obispo over these past 30 years, and having audiences that come and listen. And that's one of the things that the poets visiting will always say. They just love how the audience here listens to their poems, to their work.
So really the focus of this poetry festival is poets reading their work to an audience.
Right, and that has always been the focus of the San Luis Obispo Poetry Festival. You know, we don't really do workshops very often, but this time we're having a film to open the festival.
Yeah, and it's about a great American and Californian,
Kenneth Rexroth.
Yeah.
And that the film is called The Signature of All Things. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and so they had this celebration of the 100th anniversary of Kenneth Rexroth's birth. And so friends of his that knew him, his daughter, and poets from Los Angeles, including our own James Cushing, read a wonderful piece that Rexroth wrote on jazz. Anyway, it really is a spectacular, but it's basically a reading as well. You know.
And that film is coming up this coming Saturday, right, at Cal Poly?
7 o'clock at the Phillips Recital Hall. And tickets are $8 for general public and $6 for students and seniors. And those are the prices for all the events.
Affordable entertainment and enlightenment on the Central Coast. The 30th annual San Luis Obispo Poetry Festival coming up three weekends in a row, starting this coming Saturday, lasting through the 17th. Most events start at 7 o'clock. There are some exceptions. Sylvia, how many of these poetry festivals have you been involved in?
Goodness. I know I was involved early on, and then I really appreciate the fact that Kevin did start reaching out beyond the community and going in out and making it more something that would draw poets from out of the area. I've always attended the festivals, but not always as a reader. So I'm very glad to be reading.
Now,
this.
You're reading this festival on, what is that, Saturday, the 9th
Saturday?
Of November?
Yes.
At the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art?
Yes.
And, of course, you have your new book. What is that?
Called Caught in Flight, and it's a collection of my poems, and I'll be reading from that, and it will be available for sale.
And we will be hearing a bit of that a little bit later on in our conversation here. Sylvia Alcon reading from her new book. And we'll hear from Kevin Patrick Sullivan as well. Kevin, tell me about how poetry is integrated into your life. Are you always thinking and dreaming and working poetry? Is it your life?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm that is my calling. So at least I see myself, I identify myself as a poet. So, and I do this festival. I do two monthly readings as well, one at Linnea's at Corners of the Mouth. We've been there for, well, we're celebrating our 30th year there, too. Mm-hmm. The Steinberg Gallery, poetry at the Steinberg. So, yeah, poetry is my cup of tea, and I usually think about it and read about it, and I got poetry books in every room of my house, you know. Mm-hmm. Poetry books in the bag I carry to work every day, you know.
And how about you, Sylvia? How integrated is poetry in your life?
I think it is a big part. I'm fortunate to have a good deal of time by myself. And so I can, if a line occurs to me, then I have the time to sit down and carry that out and see where it will go. And I have to admit that I listen to Writer's Almanac every morning.
Which is one of the programs that we have weekday mornings on KCBX.
Yes.
With Garrison Keillor.
Yes. So I think that the importance of poetry now with as an oral tradition is really important, because I think we are bombarded with lots of sounds. And so maybe a challenge now is how to make poetry interesting, how it will stand out from all the noise that surrounds us.
Yeah, we are in a mobile world, and we all have our mobile devices that we carry. Is the experience of poetry different in any way now that we all have our smartphones and...
The younger poets are reading at the readings from their smartphones, you know. Yeah, it is very, the idea of the accessibility of it, the apps available from the different organizations like Poets and Writers or the Poetry Foundation. I mean, geez, you know, so it is available to these mobile phones like never before. Poetry, you know, I even have a website out there, you know. KevinPatrickSullivan.com, www.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guests are poets Kevin Patrick Sullivan and Sylvia Alcon. And Kevin is the artistic director of the upcoming San Luis Obispo Poetry Festival. It's the 30th annual, starting this Saturday, for 3 weekends, lasting through November 17th. Sylvia, most people begin reading poetry as children. I remember relishing my books that had works by Lewis Carroll and Edward Lear, people like that. Why do you think as adults we might read less poetry?
I guess first off, what comes to mind is that when I was a child, I thought of poetry as rhyming. It does kind of stay in your head, the little rhyming Ogden Nash, and you know, there's just now poetry doesn't necessarily and most often doesn't rhyme. I'm kind of afraid that some schooling has made adults feel less able. They think they're afraid. They're kind of afraid that they're not going to understand.
The fear of poetry.
The fear of poetry.
Well,
yeah.
Mariel Ruckheiser, a wonderful American poet, she has this beautiful essay called The Fear of Poetry. And part of that is, you know, poetry often is kind of taught in schools. People work after meeting and stuff instead of just letting the experience wash over you and experience the poem. You know, that, you know, a poem can have all kinds of meanings, because that's the aliveness of art, is that you interpret it. Your experiences are different from mine. Mm-hmm. And so you bring your experience to that work of art. The same is true about reading a poem or a painting or a sculpture or whatever, a movie. You know, it's all individual when it comes down to interpretation of it. You know, but then they try to say in a school, they try and...
Kind of dissecting.
Right. They try to say, this is what this was. So it takes the joy, the personal joy out of it, because they're trying to tell you that this is what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, and that may be not what, you know, that's the consensus. You know, that's all that is. We have to understand that the joy is from the experience. And I think we, as adults, we start to lose that experience of a lot of things, not just poetry. Mm-hmm. But that's, I guess, another show.
Sylvia, you had touched briefly on the importance of poetry, that you feel that poetry is probably even more important now in a world that's full of mobile devices. Why is that? Why is poetry so important?
I think that there's a distillation in a poem that, if it's done well, is able to encapsulate and convey a feeling or an image very directly, that can kind of maybe bypass some of the analytical and the dissecting qualities that we have in our minds. Just bringing...
the other. It helps you jump into the other, you know, in
okay.
a sense. You know what
yeah.
I'm saying? That experience, that poem, so it's somebody else's point of view, but it becomes yours in a sense, so you can hop into it,
mm-hmm.
share it, you know, and that's what I was talking about by the experience of it, you know, because it becomes yours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a human thing. And so when we can do that with another human, you know, and that's why poetry readings I think are, because it was an oral art and is an oral art. And of course, books are marvelous. I love books, you know, the written word, and but still, that's why I've been so involved with readings all these years, is because the interpretive flow of the language and that spark that enables a voice into your heart,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm. It's like really almost any art, music, song, listening to a song and identifying with those words that you hear, and the melody perhaps too,
oh, sure.
touches something in your heart that makes you feel a certain way or connect with a certain feeling that you might not otherwise connect with if
yes.
you were just thinking on your own. You have that help of the artist.
Right.
Yes.
Putting words to what you're feeling, even.
Or music, creating the emotion, you know, because obviously music doesn't necessarily have those words, but it, mm-hmm. it still has the emotive power to bring you into that, you know, space.
And that's often, I think, a mark of a really good poem is when it does have its own music, you know, so that you're reading a poem maybe by yourself and you find yourself saying it out loud because you can sense that there's a kind of rhythmic quality to it, and maybe that the sounds, like if the poem is about the ocean and there's lots of shushing sounds in it, you know, you find yourself reading it out loud and you're hearing it, you're going, oh yeah, you know, you're getting the whole feeling of this ocean and the mm-hmm. feeling that the writer is trying to convey.
Mm-hmm. You write a lot about nature, it seems.
I did. I was part of that collection, Poems mm-hmm. for Endangered Places. I would say this collection is probably not so much about nature. Mm-hmm. It's more about life experiences, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly use a lot of images from nature.
Let's hear something from your new book. Sylvia Alcon is a poet who is going to be reading as a part of the upcoming Poetry Festival in San Luis Obispo, and she'll be reading at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art on Saturday, November 9th at 7 o'clock in the evening, along with some other poets and a guitarist. This is from Sylvia's new book, Caught in Flight.
In pursuit of devolution, through chlorinated water, the lane lines chart our course, where near naked, rubber-finned, and goggle-eyed, we swim up and down, kicking, straining, as if effort will force our lungs to breathe underwater, and repetition will release an aquatic self who lurks within, who hints that gills were once enough, who blurs lane lines, forgets lap counts, who catches a swift current to the open sea.
Are you a swimmer?
Oh. Yeah.
Oh my, that's just marvelous.
Yeah, sometimes in the pool, I just think, what if we all just kept going.
Does that hint at some kind of feeling that you get when you're swimming?
Yes. And because I swim in a big pool, you know, sometimes it feels as though all these other swimmers are just, we're all just fish. we're just in a great big fish pool.
Let's hear one from you, Kevin. This is Kevin Patrick Sullivan reading a new poem, right?
Right. Now, this poem is titled Dark Matter. And I just got the new Smithsonian in the mail the other day, and I read about this thing about dark matter and how they figured out there's 26.8% of dark matter is, that's the stat they came up with, you know. And they discovered that by looking at the edges of the universe, and they thought these stars should be falling out or spinning away because of the mass wasn't big enough to hold them in, but somehow that was, so they came up, there's got to be something else. Well, dark matter. So this is dark matter. I, in my dark matter, connect to you in your dark matter. 26.8% of all things, all the stuff that exists. We share this like the air we breathe, the ground we stand on, the water that covers this planet, the water that makes up 60% of you, of me, of all humans, give or take a few percentage points. It is amazing what we share, more amazing still what we don't, like political boundaries, philosophical beliefs, constructs of our social life, however that plays out between the ears, yours or mine.
That reminds me a bit of we are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike.
Mm. Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. You know, and that's one of the things poetry helps connect. You know, it helps us to connect to each other. It gives us that reminder that we are indeed more alike than we are unlike, because we can latch on to the other experience, you know.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell with you, and I'm talking with Kevin Patrick Sullivan, who's a poet and also the president and artistic director of the San Luis Obispo Poetry Festival. The 30th annual festival starts this weekend and lasts through November 17th. And also Sylvia Alcon, who is a poet and author and is participating in this poetry festival on November 9th at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art. So there are a number of different locations. The Art Museum, also Steinberg Gallery, and where else?
Linnaeus Cafe, and of course, Phillips Recital Hall on the Cal Poly campus. And now, on the 15th, we are bringing Jerome Rothenberg.
Yeah, tell me about Jerome Rothenberg. That's kind of a big deal that you're bringing.
Oh, yeah. He really is an internationally known poet with over 80 books published, several assemblages of traditional and avant-garde poetry, such as Technicians of the Sacred, Shaking the Pumpkin, Revolution of the Word, the big Jewish book of poems. I mean, the guy is just unbelievable. And he lives in San Diego, and we're going to bring him here. And Glenna Lushai, she's reading too, the fabulous poet Glenna Lushai, and also publisher of Solo Press. Glenna's been publishing that for over 50 years now, I think. Mm-hmm. And a young poet, Victoria Billings, who just graduated from Cal Poly, is a selected reader. Anyway, it's going to be a great night.
Okay, and again, that's Friday, November 15th at Phillips Recital Hall on the Cal Poly campus. Victoria Billings, Glenna Lushai, and Jerome Rothenberg, all as a part of the San Luis Obispo Poetry Festival.
And there is a website if you wanted to look up the whole schedule.
And that's languageofthesoul.org.
Okay, and you're going to have an open reading as a part of your closing party, aren't you?
Right, and we also are having an open reading on the 3rd, although it's not on the poster. I forgot to put it on the poster, but on the 3rd at the Steinberg Gallery, there's an open reading following the scheduled program. And then on the actual closing night, of course, we have the big open reading closing party, and that has always been one of the biggest, hugest nights of the festival. People from near and far come and read for the open reading.
And if someone wants to be a part of that open reading, how does one do that?
Show up and sign your name on the list. You'll have 5 minutes limited to original work.
Let's talk about the difference between listening to a poet read his or her own work versus actually reading it on the printed page. It seems like some poetry lends itself more to the page, like I think of E.E. Cummings, and some lends itself more to being heard. Is that your feeling?
Oh, yes. That's a very true statement. And some poets are very good at reading their own poetry, and some poets aren't. Some of them come across, so much better when you're not in the room. and some of them, need that extra vibrancy of the live voice,
Mm-hmm. Are there trends in poetry? I mean, I know that poetry jams were really big in the 90s, for instance.
Well, there still are, I reckon. There's definite trends, but it all comes circles around, and poetry magazine's been around over 100 years. Poet Lore has been around now 28 years, or something like that. They've probably seen the trends come and go,
What are some of the trends that you've seen, and what do you think is popular right now, Sylvia?
Oh, goodness.
In the world of poetry.
I've seen YouTube poets, kind of a spoken word poetry, where to me it almost seems more like the dramatic monologue. I'm not aware of any lines or any particular images. It's more of a dramatic monologue without any script. I certainly think that it's good that we're moving away from the image of the haggard poet with the cigarette hanging out of his mouth, who kind of slumps up to the microphone and just blow him, and it's very boring, and that it's much, I think, more life has come into poetry readings, so that you're not going to get that almost like a Marlon Brando kind of image of a very self-involved poet, but it's more of a here's my poem and I want to share it with you. A little lighter, a little more less rigid somehow.
Mm-hmm. How about you? What do you think, Kevin?
Like Sylvia was saying, the spoken word and performance poetry and even, of course, the new formalism and all that kind of stuff is happening. So there's that swinging back. Dana Gioia would be all for the forms, poetry written in forms where, the beats. Charles Olson came up with this thing called projective verse. He expounded the idea of the form created as the poem is created. And so, of course, that's the philosophy I write under as well, where that poem takes shape as it is being created line by line, syllable by syllable. So the syllable creates the lines create the poem. That's the basic trend that I try to adhere to.
I think the wonderful thing, too, is that despite all the trends, what Kevin does is he really does bring a diversity of poets, so that someone coming who might feel uncertain about poetry and whether they like it or whether they'll understand it, if they stayed for an evening, they would get a spectrum and they would really see that there's so much variety.
Mm-hmm. Well, poetry is like other forms of art, or even like food, mm-hmm. There's some that you like and some that you don't like.
Yeah, of course.
And that's okay.
That is okay. That's right. I try to bring the forms that I like. But that's my prerogative, I guess.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, Sylvia Alcon and Kevin Patrick Sullivan, talking about the 30th annual San Luis Obispo Poetry Festival, starting this weekend on the 2nd at Phillips Recital Hall at Cal Poly, and going through the 17th, ending at Linnea's Cafe. If you want more information about the festival, where does one find that information, Kevin?
LanguageOfTheSoul.org.
Okay, LanguageOfTheSoul.org. And if one wants more information about you, Sylvia, how does one find that?
You can go to the Big Yes Press website. That's just bigyespress.org.
And how about you? What's yours?
KevinPatrickSullivan.com.
Okay. Thank you very much. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.
And you're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Coming up at 2 o'clock this afternoon, it's On Being. Immunologist Esther Sternberg is a pioneer in a new frontier that's giving rise to disciplines like neuroimmunology and environmental psychology. She says all of us can create surroundings and even portable sensations to manage stress and tap our brain's own internal pharmacies. That's On Being at 2 o'clock. Still ahead on Issues and Ideas, Cal Poly Emeritus Professor of History Dan Krieger discusses cemeteries and the Day of the Dead, along with Halloween history and how they all impact our culture today. But up first, Donna Cheek talks with the program coordinator of Partners in Equestrian Therapy.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. Today, my guest is Melanie Williams-Mahan, Program Coordinator for Partners in Equestrian Therapy. Thank you, Melanie, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I read on your website that your program provides therapeutic horseback riding for children and adults with disabilities. Why is horseback riding therapeutic?
One of the things I think that horseback riding does for them, and one of the things I see my riders liking every day, is there's a sense of empowerment with working with the horses. We have a lot of kids on the autism spectrum and adults, and the horses tend to be very non-judgmental, and they have this sense of how to take care of their rider and who to take care of. I mean, it's really amazing to watch them work. And the kids are doing things, and the adults are doing things that they wouldn't normally be able to do, but they're on horseback. One of the things, too, when you're riding a horse, what you don't realize is that your rear end is sending a lot of messages to your brain. And the movement of the horse actually stimulates a lot of little communication pathways, and it really tends to settle people down. I know from my experience, it's just one of the most peaceful things to do is work with these horses, and our horses are fantastic. But, you know, that's the common thread there, I think, is, you know, just the kids and adults' ability to be able to communicate with them and have a sense of accomplishment, because not everybody can ride a horse.
That's very true.
Yeah.
When a person comes to you, do you develop a program based on what their challenges are?
My two instructors, Amy Light and Marcia Manzoros, are both path trained. And PATH is Professional Association of Therapeutic Horsemanship. And they're a national, international organization that provides training for us and safety standards. So what it would look like is if somebody comes in and wants to ride with us, we get a doctor's release saying that it's okay for them to physically ride, even with whatever disability they've got going on. And we use that doctor's release to make a lesson plan. Every individual has their own lesson plan. And sometimes it depends on what the rider is working on. If they want to work on social things, then we have them do group rides. My teachers are very good at setting up these individual lesson plans, and we want to make it fun, which
That's
is
good.
One of the most important things, because if you're having fun and you're learning at the same time, then what could be better?
When I went out there, being in the horse business, I have been very aware of therapeutic riding and its existence and its effectiveness, but I'd never seen it in action. So coming to your place was the first time that I had seen it. I didn't realize how many people are involved with the lesson. Mm-hmm. You have the sidewalkers mm-hmm. who are on the side of the horse, mm-hmm. maintaining balance and safety and mm-hmm. correct. Then you have the lead person, and then you have the person actually giving the lesson.
Yeah, exactly.
So it takes a village,
doesn't
it? It
takes a village, and we have that great village. Our lead walkers are people that really have a lot of horse experience, and their responsibility is to be at the head of that horse and to, you know, you'll know when a horse is getting upset or getting afraid of something, and they are horses, so we have to make sure that they feel safe too. We usually start out with a lead walker and two sidewalkers with our new riders just to see what their ability is, and we just had a two-year-old ride with us for the first time the other day, so that was pretty exciting, and we had three sidewalkers, which I don't know how we did that, but we did it. As their balance gets better and their core strength builds up, then we can pull away the sidewalkers and eventually pull away the lead walker too. With some of our really young riders, we don't, you know, pull the lead walker away for a long time. And it's really, really fun. Probably my favorite games of all is, it's called the cow game. And we get a couple of our riders on horseback. And then we send the volunteers out into the arena and they pretend to be cows. So... we make a moo and everything. It's really fun. Yeah, exactly. Because so I have to do it, so I make them do it too. So.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, they have to moo and try to run away from the rider. And, you know, pretty soon the rider's cantering and doesn't even know that he's cantering or she's cantering, and they're turning and steering on their own. And it's such a
cows.
Fun game, and they're herding cows.
That is perfect, because children love to play pretend games. And they're able to be on a horse chasing pretend cows around the arena. That just seems like so much fun.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with Partners for Equestrian Therapy, or PET?
My mother met a woman that was in charge of PATH. And this was when I had first moved here. And she called me and said, hey, you know, I just heard about this great thing called therapeutic riding. And this woman was the president of, it was then called NARA, which was North American Riding for the Handicapped Association, but now it's turned into PATH. And she met her, called me, and said, look it up. Well, about that time, I saw an ad in the paper for board members. So, for PET. So I went over and became immediately just immersed in the whole thing. And I became board chair. And then I started running the program. So that's kind of how it got started. And I just fell in love with the whole idea of therapeutic riding.
Had you done any riding before?
I'm, I guess, what you would call kind of a natural rider. I don't do a lot of, I haven't done a lot of lessons, but I kind of get on the horses and tend to just exercise them.
So how long have you been with PET?
Oh, I guess it's been about 8 years now. Nine years.
Wow. That's fabulous.
While.
Now, didn't PET used to be in San Luis Obispo?
It was. We were at La Alameda Ranch, and they changed ownership at that ranch. So we moved out to Rancho Del Rio last November. We moved November 1st. I think it was right around that time.
Oh, so it'll be your anniversary is coming up.
You're right. I didn't even think about that.
1 year.
Yeah.
That was a great visit because it brought back so many memories. Having trained hunters and jumpers out there at Rancho Del Rio.
One of our little boys that rides with us, he's five, and he loves watching the jumpers in the other arena. He loves to watch them, and that's what I think he wants to do eventually. We call him, he's like a little cowboy. He's just the cutest thing, and he just wants to go fast. So
that's cute.
Yeah.
Fearless.
He's fearless, yeah. He wants to go fast.
Do you have any of them that come and have some innate fear of horses?
It's usually not a fear of horses so much as just a fear of animals, maybe. And we had one child that came in that was afraid of everything, from bugs to dogs to cats, anything pretty much that was alive and would, you know, come towards him. He didn't really like it that well. So the family brought him to us, and his little sister came in too. And one of the things we did, we started with a picnic in the arena. And we had the little boy sit outside the arena, and he had his picnic, and we sat in the arena with the Tana. And we did that, and then eventually we got his little sister on Atana, and he could see that, you know, Atana was okay. And then after a few weeks, it took a few weeks, we got him on Atana. And Atana was so fantastic. She didn't even sneeze until he was ready. I don't know if he had no fear, but he was certainly better off than he was before he came to us with the animals. And it was fun for him.
It sounds that way.
Mm-hmm. And we have one boy that's been riding with us. Gosh, I don't even know how long. It was before I got involved, and he's a great rider, and he likes to get his horse to canter when we're not looking. So once he found out how to do it, he was like, "Oh, this is going to be fun."
That is so neat.
It's nice to know, you know, to know that he has someplace to go and have that fun. And he does a lot of Special Olympics and stuff too. But
cool.
I think he really likes his horseback riding.
I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. We are talking with Melanie Williams-Mahan, Program Coordinator for Partners in Equestrian Therapy. Let's talk about your veterans program.
We just started our veterans program in the last year. Thanks to the Roy and Ida Eagle Foundation, they gave us a scholarship, a grant, and part of the grant was for scholarships for veterans and their families. And the other part of the grant was what allowed us to get our new Norwegian Fjord, Ben, who came from Montana. They're mini draft horses, so they can carry a lot of weight, but they're short, so we can sidewalk with them too. But the veterans program, one of the things that we're doing that's a little different from some of the other veterans programs is we want veterans to bring their families in and come have a nice, fun family day. And we've had a veteran and his family coming in riding, and it's been really, really nice. And all of it is free of charge, thanks to the Roy and Ida Eagle Foundation for veterans. Yeah, we're pretty excited about
it. So that's something that you want to grow. You
yes.
want that component of
yes.
the program to grow.
Mm-hmm. And we did a kind of an introductory thing. We had a ride this last summer at Madonna Inn. So we had 45 veterans come out and ride, and it was so much fun. And it was all paid for by them. So it was.
So the veterans, they can be any veteran, not a veteran that's dealing with a disability?
Yeah, any veteran. And, you know, one of the things we noticed about when veterans come back and they have post-traumatic stress, it's a lot easier to come out and just play with the horse than it is to go ask for help in other ways, I think. And people just kind of have a great time and enjoy the horses and enjoy the ranch. And we've been really happy with it so far.
That whole environment is so therapeutic. The horses just communicate that type of peace and tranquility and all that stuff that they just do naturally.
Well, and it's funny because they know how you're feeling before you know how you're feeling. And they're almost like a mirror. You come in and you work with them, and it's really hard to come in and work with them and not be happy.
Are there any particular disabilities that you have found respond best to riding?
I think we tend to get a lot of people with on the autism spectrum, because one of the things we do for the younger kids that don't want to maybe not necessarily talk in public, they're really shy and don't want to talk. One of the things we ask them to do is tell the horse what they want the horse to do. As in, if they want the horse to walk, they say walk on. And we ask them to use the horse's name and tell them to walk on. They tell them to whoa. They tell them to trot. They tell them to canter. So it's nice, and they don't even realize that they're communicating that way, and the horse is responding.
And besides, it's safe to speak to a horse.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, there's no judgment.
Are your students referred by doctors?
A lot of our referral, I think, is word of mouth. In the special needs community, you know, people meet with each other and talk with each other, and it's nice.
Okay,
we love it that way.
Sometimes parents will seek you out.
Yes.
On behalf mm-hmm. of their child.
We had a little girl a long time ago, and she was in a wheelchair. And one of the first things she said when she got on the horse and started walking was she turned to her dad and said, "Now I know what it feels like to walk." It makes it all worth it right there, doesn't it?
Wow.
So, and you know, they get to do things that even kids with no disabilities can't do, and they excel at it. And that's one of the things that we really do. We're not just pony rides. We teach these kids and adults how to ride.
I bet this is so therapeutic for parents to see. I'm sure that they get just as much out of it as their children, to see their children do things and step out of themselves. And they have limits and they have boundaries that are imposed on them mm-hmm. because of their disability. And a horse can help them beyond mm-hmm. those limits.
And we have some parents that ride too. It's a new thing that PATH started talking about a few years ago, and it's called inclusive therapy. And it's really fun for a young rider to have their parent there, because then they kind of get to show off. And we usually have the parents following the rider, because the rider has been doing this for a while, so they know what they're doing. It's fun for the rider, and it's fun for that whole family. So
you guys are doing a great work out there.
I love it.
You really, really are. Are you going to do this forever?
I think so. You know, I get this therapy all the time, and it's just because I get to go out and work with them. I feel very lucky and very blessed to be able to work with the horses I work with and the people I work with. And Cindy Nacy, as you know, the barn owner of Rancho Del Rio, is one of the nicest people on the planet, I think.
Yes.
And she's made us feel very, very welcome there. And she's got a great facility, and I love my job. My volunteers make it really, really easy, and I'm always looking for new volunteers too. So if anybody wants to come in and work with us. There's always different things to do for us, too. I need help with computer stuff. We have a website now that I can't really update myself, so I'm looking for somebody that has Mac experience with a website. So that's...
Yes. Yeah. I was looking at your website. It does need to be updated.
Yeah, I've still got us in San Luis.
Yes.
So, but yeah, we're, you know, so we're looking for all kinds of different things. I used to have one woman that would come in and organize the office for us, and that was her contribution. And
nice.
Whether you have to have horse experience or not, it's not an issue, because we can teach you how to work with our horses, and they're so sweet and so nice. It's a good way to learn. If somebody is a little bit afraid of horses, and once they meet ours, it's a whole different ballgame.
And you are a 501c3.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Well, good. I hope that some of our listeners may be intrigued with what you're doing and would get involved in some way. Thank you, Melanie, for coming in to talk with me today.
Oh,
I so appreciate
welcome.
Your time. And I'm Donna Cheek with Issues and ID.
And you're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Coming up next, Brian Reynolds of the San Luis Obispo Library discusses Halloween, the Day of the Dead, and cemeteries with Cal Poly Emeritus Professor of History, Dan Krieger.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by local historian Dan Krieger, and given the season, we're going to talk about cemeteries and some scary things. Welcome, Dan.
Good to be here with you, Brian.
Tell me a little bit about cemeteries and why they're so important, please.
Well, they're hardly a dead topic historically or sociologically. Cemeteries tell us a lot about the way we were when a particular cemetery was created. Just think of ancient Egypt and the power of Pharaoh and the necessity of having a living god amongst the people. Well, what do you do when the god dies? You have to create a kind of mythos that the god has merely gone west and his remains are here with us. We're taking care of them. They're very secure. Look at our pyramid. Look at our Valley of the Dead that's almost hidden off the Upper Nile River and such. And you realize that there are an infinite number of stories that come out of just that kind of construction. Much of our modern association with cemeteries comes out of the Roman practices. The Romans built their cemeteries away from the city. They did not want the dead in the city itself. They cremated their dead chemically, not by fire, but they would build these monuments along the roads with inscriptions. And the inscriptions tell us so much. You can recreate a good deal of Roman history simply from the inscriptions. In fact, Roman historians for years have relied on those, and now increasingly so as we look at the more simple tombs of a prosperous baker. It tells you a little bit about how he got his money and what he did with it and so on, and you begin to understand much more of the details of daily operations in ancient Rome. Well, we do that here in San Luis Obispo County also when we look at our cemeteries. There's some wonderful cemeteries, a lot of them private, and you realize that during the period of the first American pioneers coming to this county, things were very isolated, and so if a family member died, you couldn't very well haul them into town. It might be a 1 or 2 day journey, and that could be disastrous, of course, in warm weather. So they buried people right there. What happens when the land is sold? Sometimes a cemetery is forgotten. Often there is an easement provided to maintain the integrity of the cemetery, but nobody comes to visit it anymore. And I find it rather interesting to go out at the invitation of a local landowner and take a look at a cemetery that he has just found on his place. He didn't even know it was there. And we try to find out who the family was and reestablish connections. Usually those graves are very simple, and sometimes there isn't even a fence around the cemetery. The fence has long since fallen down. But that, too, is a telling feature. The earliest cemeteries in our county were those of the Chumash, the Salinan, and the Yokut Native Americans who lived here for thousands of years. Each of those groups had their own specific burial practices. When I was a young student of anthropology and ethnology, we used to look at those graves much more closely than we do now. The Native American Burial Act of the late 1960s and other legislation has controlled what people can do to the graves of Native Americans, and that was long overdue. On a few occasions when I was a student, I was expected to handle Native American bones, and I felt kind of crummy afterwards that I was disrespecting someone's ancestors. And that's exactly the way the Native Americans view that specific issue. And as a historian for the Salinan tribe of San Luis Obispo, Monterey, and San Benito counties, I have been privileged to be at some reburials of bones that have been found in an archaeological dig. They're turned over to the county coroner, and then the county coroner returns them to the appropriate Native American agency for reburial, and it's a wonderful thing to see. But those graves occurred in specific areas above the bluffs at Avila Beach, driving out towards the Old Port Wharf. There were many, many burials, and early explorers saw large groups of Native Americans there who would often shout out to the ships at sea, "We recognize you." Sometimes they would say "Españoles, Cristianos." And this is in the in 1601, 1603. We now speculate that they wanted foreigners to stay away. It was not an invitation.
It was a warning.
A warning, because this was a sacred spot.
How does a farmer that, like you visited, find out that there was a graveyard there? Or how do people find out about Native American cemeteries? What physical clues or not are available?
Well, there aren't too many physical clues. Often the land can simply be flat, and the rancher is out walking. If he hasn't been told in the escrow documents from the title insurance company and such that there's an easement for a cemetery, a family cemetery on your plot, it comes as sort of a shock. Who's buried there? When did this happen? And it's we go back over the line of title, and we try to establish whose cemetery it was. And in most cases, the new owner wants to contact the old family members and tell them you're welcome to come and look at the grave. And there's no thought of removing the remains. I don't know of any instance where remains have actually been extracted by family members, but the new owners will usually treat that spot with respect. In one case, a gentleman told me, "Darn it, I was going to build something right there, and now I guess I can't do it." But that's the extent of it. Native American remains, if they are found, must be immediately reported to the San Luis Obispo County Sheriff Coroner's Office, and they will tell you what to do after that. All construction has to stop immediately. That's why we have Native American monitors at any large construction projects, but occasionally just digging up for a gas line or something, remains are found, and you must at that point stop.
Are remains of the Native Americans sometimes subject of a political struggle? In other words, I seem to remember reading about the last wild Indian in California, Ishii, that where his bones wound up, that was a bit of a dispute.
Well, it wasn't so much his bones as his brain.
His brain.
His brain was shipped off by one of the fathers of American anthropology, Alfred Kroeber, to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and no thought was given to treating it the way I might want my parents' remains treated. It was simply something of anthropological interest. This is back in the days when anthropologists were looking at the size of different people's brains. There was a good deal of racism. I'm not implying that Kroeber was a racist, but there was a good deal of racism involved in this, and the Smithsonian had huge collections. Skulls from this county, as I've written in my column, were actually shipped off to a medical college in Birmingham, England, for study, where they just sat in a safe. And those remains were later, thanks to John Birch, who's the traditional lead of the Salinan tribe and a wonderful liaison at the University of Birmingham, they were returned to this county, and they've been very reverentially reburied.
I'm a student of English history and very interested in the kings of the different lines, like the Plantagenets. Richard III was the last king of that line and killed in battle, I believe, also the last king. And recently, I believe, they discovered his bones in a parking lot.
I drove by that parking lot in Leicester 3 or 4 times in my life and never thought Richard III would be there. But, you know, finding those bones confirms what Shakespeare has to say about his being a hunchback.
Right.
He also had many, many other medical problems. Whether or not he was guilty of killing the two princes in the tower remains a mystery. But I remember being in England, I think it's August 18th, which is his birthday, and all of these people who proclaim his innocence take out ads in the papers to celebrate this much maligned king.
Yeah, I believe he was only king for a couple of years.
Sure, yeah.
Didn't last very long. I know there's some events coming up that are of interest to our audience. Could you talk a little bit about those events?
Sure. I'll try to handle them chronologically. The first occurs on Halloween itself. For the last 20-plus years, I have done a tour of the cemeteries here in San Luis Obispo. It's free and open to the public. Thanks to the daylight savings time moving into November, we now have more light. It used to be a flashlight tour to see the graves. But we start at 4 o'clock at the Old Mission Cemetery off Bridge Street. That's right behind the Pacific Coast Center off Lower Higuera Street in San Luis Obispo. It's a walking tour, but I'm semi-handicapped, and if I can lead it, anyone can come along, and people do come in wheelchairs and various other things. And we take a look at the graves in that cemetery, and we try to say what they tell us about the way things were when the cemetery was first constructed in the 1860s and how it has evolved. We'll talk about the mausoleum, and that's often a fascinating topic for people. And we'll look at some of the people who are in the mausoleum, including Ah Louis, who never entered a Catholic church in his life, but there's just a wonderful story about how he ended up in that mausoleum and how so many members of the Chinese Louis family converted to Catholicism to be there with him. And the tour will be over in time to get home for the trick-or-treat kids coming to your door. The second event occurs on All Souls Day itself. That's November 2nd. And I believe it's from 1 to 4 in the Odd Fellows Cemetery, which is across the street from the Mission Cemetery. And that's being put on by the County History Center. It's going to be a living history kind of thing where they'll have people reenacting the people who are buried beneath the ground. And for further information on that, call the History Center at 805-543-0638. Or you could just go online to History Center San Luis Obispo. It sounds like a wonderful event. My friend Joe Morris, who's worked with me on tours before, is going to be narrating that, and we'll be doing much the same thing that I'll be doing at the Mission Cemetery.
Great. I would encourage everybody to take advantage of some of those events. This is Brian Reynolds, San Luis Obispo County Library Director for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by local historian and Cal Poly professor retired, Dan Krieger, and we're talking about cemeteries and some scary topics given the season. Dan, tell me about cemeteries, given that people who could afford it would probably have a more elaborate memorial for their departed loved one. Are we looking at cemeteries being histories of the more wealthy class? How does that work?
Well, to a large extent, monumentalism is a product of wealth. And very often, the wealthiest want their own private mausoleums, and it really stands out. But it was amazing in the 19th century how families would come together to put up a monument even though they could ill afford it. It was a tribute to their family, and there's that strong feeling. I think it's part of the immigrant nation that we are, that people came over here in the old world, in Europe. They never could own land. This was especially true of the Irish, but of almost all the European immigration to a large extent. They would come over here. They would work hard. They would have some resources. They would have some land. And when the founding father, the first immigrant to America, died, they would want an appropriate tribute to them. And so they would spend inordinately on these monuments. And you can just go through our county graveyards from Guadalupe all the way up to the Cayuga Lucas District Cemetery, just off Highway 1 in front of Whale Rock Dam. And you can see these very tall winged angels and statuary figures on the monuments and such. And those did not always come from wealthy families. This is the tribute. And some of the private mausoleums are much the same way. And bear in mind, these were put up when those statues were not locally made. You had to order them in San Francisco at Colma, which is the town just south of San Francisco, the city of the dead, and they had statuary makers there. They would be shipped down by ship initially until the Southern Pacific Railway came through in 1894, always by ship, and that would be a great expense, and they'd have to be carted to the cemetery, and they would have to be erected there. So the expense was immoderate, to say the least, but they were there as a tribute, and you can look at those families. Some of the families today still own lots of land. Others have disappeared because they lost their land in one of the droughts or the economic decline of 1893, of 1904, of 1929, or even more recently.
We were talking earlier about societal trends in cemeteries where monuments of yesteryear were not, maybe don't fit into modern needs to, say, even mow the lawns in a cemetery. Is that true?
That is absolutely true. The first person to insist on this was the man who founded Forest Lawn Cemetery in Glendale, California. And he looked at efficient management of cemeteries. He built large monuments on the grounds to attract visitors. And Forest Lawn is still a place that gets a lot of tourism. Of course, it had a novel written about it by Evelyn Waugh called The Loved One, which still attracts a lot of attention. But he wanted the gravestones down on the ground so the lawnmowers could go right over them. And other cemeteries began to look at that and realize if they were going to have effective ground management to stay within their endowment income, they would have to do that. And so it's changed the whole nature of cemeteries. The large monuments were largely ignored, no longer permitted. And some of those older cemeteries, in fact, fell into disrepair. The Mission Cemetery here in San Luis Obispo went through that kind of period until modern management came in and an endowment was finally put up by the bishop. We weren't our own diocese in the period from the 1860s when the cemetery was first created. We were part of the Diocese of Monterey, Los Angeles, and the headquarters was in Los Angeles. And so this was a backwater, and the bishop never really attended to setting up an endowment. And so it became overgrown. And finally, in 1962, the Diocese of Monterey was created, and Bishop Harry Clinch looked at the grounds and said, this is a disgrace, and he collared enough people to put money into a management fund, but the newer graves at the Mission Cemetery are all flat on the ground, and they contrast with the old ones, which are now well-maintained.
Could you please talk a little bit about the cemeteries in the county? You've mentioned a couple of them, the Oddfellows, the Mission. What are some other noteworthy cemeteries?
Well, there are two cemeteries very near one another. One is the old St. Patrick Cemetery in Arroyo Grande, which is on North Branch Street, right between two shopping centers. It has, among other people buried there, John Michael Price, for whom Price Canyon is named, and he's the real founder of Pismo Beach and once owned a vast land grant that he got from Isaac Sparks, who he once worked for. And then just across the freeway on Halcyon, the Halcyon turnoff, is the Arroyo Grande District Cemetery. And there are many graves in there of leaders of our county who have county supervisors, county sheriffs, and such. It's fun to go through there. There's only one mausoleum on the grounds of that cemetery because it fell under a new law that said public cemeteries could only have one mausoleum on them. And so it's not as cluttered with the ancillary buildings as some of the other cemeteries, nor does it have that many monuments because it was founded in later years. But you can go through there and just see the names on the graves, look at the dates, born in Ireland, born in the on the island of Little Pico or Big Pico in the Azores, so on and so forth. And it just tells you a whole lot about who made up our county, the dairy farmers, the Portuguese, and so on.
Swiss Italians. If a person is looking for a particular grave, say of an ancestor or celebrity, is there a typically easy way to find out a registry? Has that happened?
There is not a common registry to this county, but the County Genealogical Society has done a wonderful job of pulling this together, and their website offers all sorts of hints about how to find a grave, and that's the first thing I would do. Often, if it's a person who is Roman Catholic, it's relatively easy to find them, and we do have lists of everyone buried in the Mission Cemetery and in St. Patrick's Cemetery, in the Santa Rosa Cemetery up in Cambria, and so on and so forth.
As a librarian, I know how important history is, and I think it often gets not enough attention, but I would like to put a plug in for our county library where we do offer space and other amenities to the Genealogy Society. There's a small library in the Oroya Grande Library, and also a larger one in the San Luis Obispo Library, and I've always been very proud to be a partner in that worthy endeavor.